Paper 2, Section 2, which is old single column, page 35. It's probably all we need to just remind ourselves where we were last time is, what the title of that first section is, the infinity of God. So we're talking about the nature of God. So the first they address the infinity side, and now they're going to address the eternal side. So you have this little pair of sections that they start off with, infinity and eternity. So let's see what they have to say from the eternity perspective.
The Father's eternal perfection. Even your olden prophets understood the eternal, never beginning, never ending, circular nature of the universal Father. God is literally and eternally present in his universe of universes. He inhabits the present moment with all his absolute majesty and eternal greatness. The Father has life in himself, and this life is eternal life. Throughout the eternal ages, it has been the Father who gives to all life. There is infinite perfection in the divine integrity. I am the Lord, I change not. Our knowledge of the universe of universes discloses not only that he is the Father of lights, but also that in his conduct of interplanetary affairs, there is no variableness, neither shadow of changing. He declares the end from the beginning. He says, "My counsel shall stand. I will do all my pleasures according to the eternal purpose which I purposed in my Son." Thus are the plans and purposes of the first source and center like himself, eternal, perfect, and forever changeless. There is finality of completeness and perfection of repleteness in the mandates of the Father. Whatsoever God does, it shall be forever. Nothing can be added to it, nor anything taken from it. The universal Father does not repent of his original purposes of wisdom and perfection. His plans are steadfast, his counsel immutable, while his acts are divine and infallible. 1,000 years in his sight are but as yesterday, when it is past and as a watch in the night. The perfection of divinity and the magnitude of eternity are forever beyond the full grasp of the circumscribed mind of mortal man.
Okay, so I thought I'd let him play out those two paragraphs, because he's again bringing a whole bunch of Old and New Testament passages strung together into a living context there. It's kind of fun to just watch how he does that. The one, we start to get into some points with a little bit more intrigue when you get into the second paragraph there. Now, again, we've talked about this some in the past. They love to do the completeness, repleteness, dual statement, and just, appreciate what that means, that you're playing off the words literally, complete is filled all the way up, and then it's filled all the way up again, replete. So think about the way they're using them there. Okay, there is finality of completeness and perfection of repleteness. When you're talking about perfection, you're talking about reality. So just see the image that they're painting. You have it all filled all the way up with actuality, and then you fill it all the way up again with reality. That's the way they're using the the words there to bring them in parallel with actuality and reality. So you know, rather than you know, the RE prefix kind of just being even more of an intensifier than the COM prefix, you know, they're using them quite literally. They want you to think, no, again, literally think about filling it all up again, making it all new again with something that can be added to the completeness. So it's always fun to just, you know, the way they use the language with such directness and bring it alive like that. Such a really, yeah. Now the other thing in there, and they like to do this. You know, you have some things in the Old Testament that hearken back, you know, back into Egyptian and whatnot wisdom. You know, we talked about that some way back when we were reading that part of the book, and so there's things in the Bible that, you know, really are a challenge to a lot of the more simplistic ideas about God that are coming more from just that basic band of Semitic tribes that are behind, you know, thinking about Yahweh and exalting that idea. You know, there's a lot of baggage that they have attached to that. And one of the things that's coming up here. So, whatsoever God does, it shall be forever. Nothing can be added to it, nor anything taken away from it. Okay, see, that's from Ecclesiastes. Okay, and then see what they contrast that with. They're kind of saying, okay, you've got that passage. Think about that. Now, remind yourself of a whole bunch of things in the Old Testament that are just in direct contradiction to that. All those times that you've got the Father repenting of something. Okay? You know, and take one a story that everyone knows, even if you don't, you know, you've never even read the Old Testament. I mean, everyone knows Noah's Ark. Okay? You know, and so what happens at the end of that story? God repents. He goes, oh, you know, I really shouldn't have done that. I promise I'll never do it again. No matter how bad you get. You know, and so you had, you know, that was the very anthropomorphic God notion that those ancient peoples had, you know, and it's all over in there. But, you know, there's always been a wisdom that transcended that kind of primitive thinking that's been in play in the Near East, you know, going all the way back to the prince's staff. You know, and that comes out some. And so they like to point out those things. It's like, okay, you know, here they are, juxtaposed. Where's the truth? You can see the truth, can't you? You know, recognize that that those notions of God repenting, that's illogical. You know, that's an anthropomorphic and very limited anthropomorphic notion of God. So they're always trying to not allow the biblical scholars, you know, the way that the hand that they've had over the centuries of rationalizing around that stuff. You know, they love to stick it right up in black and white, you know, and challenge you with it. I just wanted to point that out there. You know, and the rest is, you know, it's just very straightforward. You know, I mean, logically, God is infinite and eternal, and that has consequences. It means that all those simplistic notions of God are impossible. You need to challenge yourselves to have a God that can be infinite and eternal, logically, literally. See how he builds on this some more here.
The reactions of a changeless God in the execution of his eternal purpose may seem to vary in accordance with the changing attitude and the shifting minds of his created intelligences. That is, they may apparently and superficially vary. But underneath the surface and beneath all outward manifestations, there is still present the changeless purpose the everlasting plan of the eternal God. Out in the universes, perfection must necessarily be a relative term. But in the central universe, and especially on paradise, perfection is undiluted. In certain phases, it is even absolute. Trinity manifestations vary the exhibition of the divine perfection, but do not attenuate it.
Okay, so that first paragraph, you know, is challenging. Yeah, sure, you have a subjective recognition, initially very, very subjective recognition of the fact of God. But none of that subjectivity is imposed upon God by you. God is an absolute objective fact. So they're trying to stress that. And then that fun little comment there for the more advanced thinker, you know, with the revelation. Trinity manifestations vary the exhibition of the divine perfection, but do not attenuate it. What does that mean? Trinity, why Trinity? You know, that's what we've, you know, now very definitively have in front of us. We know that there's the original, the universal one of infinity. That origin and foundation. And it has two faces. From one side, from the first center side, comes existential deity. From the other side, from the Paradise Trinity side, comes experiential deity. Okay? So that's what they're invoking there. Experiential deity varies the exhibition of the divine perfection, you know, as opposed to existential deity. But it doesn't attenuate it. So to appreciate that about, even though we're bringing in this initially very different notion from anything that humans have tried to play with in their attempts to understand God, this is, you know, this very definitive notion of experiential deity instead of just existential deity. Even though we're bringing that in, don't make the mistake of thinking that somehow there isn't divinity still. It's deity. Just because it's experiential deity doesn't mean it's not deity. And deity is divine, period. Okay? Existential or experiential or whatever. It's deity, it's divine. So that, you know, that God as immanence, that experiential deity, that God that's within, intimately around us, God the Mother, is divine still. Even though she's all the way down here with those of us who are far from divine, the moment that she upholds is a divine dispensation. You know, despite the fact that we aren't divine. Again, objective, subjective. See how the two paragraphs work together? That experiential deity is still something that's coming down. It's an objective fact. And even though it comes all the way down to the lowliest, you and I, you and me, man, I'm terrible at that. You and me, doesn't mean that you attenuate, that you spread out that, you know, divinity until it's paper thin and fragile or anything. No, it's still rock solid, integrous divinity. Okay. All right, so there's a subtlety, see, of association between those two paragraphs. You know, they're even separated by large gaps and put together as a pair. You know, it's a little challenge. Can you understand everything we're saying here enough where you recognize how these two paragraphs are one voice? It's all kinds of just delightful little constructs like that, see, in the Revelation that you can engage and figure out.
You know, what I got out of that second paragraph was the fact that, you know, But do not, Trinity manifestations vary the exhibition of divine perfection, but do not attenuate it. In order to do that, there has to be a recognition of that Father principle first, you know, in order to harmonize it, integrate it. And it kind of reminds me of a very down-to-earth example of when I first learned to drive a car, and it was, you know, in high school, and you had a driver instructor, and he said, the first thing you got to do is look, keep your eye on the road. That's your direction. You got to get your direction. And then once you're comfortable with keeping your eyes on the road, then you can kind of look around, you know, but you always got to come back to your eyes on the road. You can't look, you can't, you know. So it's like, you know, and it's the same, it's kind of a similar technique for us, you know, except maybe we get our direction from the Father and then we look around more, but then it's just a constant to fill the holes in the Swiss cheese, you know. It's like getting those the light of the Father into those areas of the life and integrating it, you know, the inspiration.
I was just going to say this first sentence about the changing attitude and the shifting minds of his script.
Mm-hmm.
That reminds me of what you were saying about the Yahweh and stuff. That's the way their attitude is, what their God is, a vengeful God. He's a jealous God. He's a wrathful God. But, you know, it's totally, that's not really him at all.
Yeah, and, you know, in that first paragraph of the section, they quoted from James, you know, in the New Testament, the bit about is no variableness, neither shadow of changing. You know, God doesn't vary, not even in the slightest. Okay, you know, not even a shadow of changing. Okay, not in the slightest. You know, and again, they're trying to remind you. I mean, you guys all know those. You know, and just ask yourself which thought rings truer to you. That or, you know, the anthropomorphic guy throwing a tantrum. Okay? Which sounds like God. It's not rocket science. You know, just allow yourself to recognize the obvious, you know, and upstep your notions of God. Let history be history. You know, it's not that those people, those ancient people, were looked down upon by God. God loved them just as absolutely as he loves you. But you don't have to limit your mind to their primitive estate.
Well, wasn't one of the Yahweh concepts the volcano guy?
Right, he was the volcano god initially.
That sounds like he was kind of PO'd at something.
Right. Volcano gods are always PO'd at something. Volcano gods.
You can see where their rationale came from.
Yeah.
As incorrect as it
is. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I know. People still think that, too.
Yeah, it doesn't matter if it's which volcano god it is. Pele is the same way. So yeah, just and you know, that's fine for them all those millennia ago. Not now. Now is time to be about a little bit more of an adult notion of God. Use your reality response, you know. That's what they're doing. They're putting two things in front of you. They're going, reality response or reality response? No. This has a reality response. I know this to be true.
Yeah, you know, it wouldn't give you any comfort at all to think of a God like that. But this makes you know and have comfort that knowing that God's not going to change no matter what happens, that he's always going to be there holding you, loving you.
Right, yeah. But those people, the notion of comfort didn't compel them. You know, fear compelled them, you know, and... remember the times, you know, they're in that cattle prod mode where the only reason that anything is going anywhere is because of fear and hunger.
And they knew that God was unhappy with them. So it wasn't on debate. There's no equivocating. He's upset right now. Just look at that mountain. He's upset.
Yeah, that does not look like a happy place to be.
Yeah. It's a deity expression.
Right. So,
right. I mean, it's not like they didn't have, you know, an airtight rationalization going on. I mean, they, you know, some of them were very intelligent. They were, you know, they could put things together tightly rational, but it was just such a circumscribed viewpoint of things. All right. What else does he give us?
God's primal perfection consists not in an assumed righteousness, but rather in the inherent perfection of the goodness of his divine nature. He is final, complete, and perfect. There is no thing lacking in the beauty and perfection of his righteous character. And the whole scheme of living existences on the worlds of space is centered in the divine purpose of elevating all will creatures to the high destiny of the experience of sharing the Father's paradise perfection. God is neither self-centered nor self-contained. He never ceases to bestow himself upon all self-conscious creatures of the vast universe of universes.
And that's in that end there is another fun one. I mean, you've got the part that's immediately accessible to everyone that's reading that. You know, again, he's not anthropomorphic, okay? But, you know, think about the key words in there, self-centered and self-contained. Okay, we're talking about God the Father here. That's the main focus of what we're talking about. And at the root of God the Father, there's these six facets, six aspects to God the Father. And the root of that is the first center. Okay? There is a root, you know, and he established that center himself. Okay? It's a self-established center. Okay? And self-contained deity, that's the universal one of infinity. That's, you know, that both of those in a technical sense are referring to that root of the Father, the first center, but there's more to the Father than just the first center. He reaches out from that anchor. Bestowing himself, as the universal Father and the universal Creator and the universal Controller and the infinite Upholder, even bestowing himself as the first source, of course, too, even behind that. Once you think of the Father extending out from that root, you have nothing but giving, to the fullness that giving is possible. But it's kind of fun the way they're saying, okay, now, in any simplistic notion, don't think of him as an anthropomorphic, self-centered phenomenon, but there's this tiny little thread of truth in there that you, as a more advanced understander of the nature of God the Father, can appreciate. That at the core there is the first center, which is self-centered and self-contained deity.
God is eternally and infinitely perfect. He cannot personally know imperfection as his own experience, but he does share the consciousness of all the experience of imperfectness of all the struggling creatures of the evolutionary universes of all the Paradise Creator Sons. The personal and liberating touch of the God of perfection overshadows the hearts and encircles the natures of all those mortal creatures who have ascended to the universe level of moral discernment. In this manner, as well as through the contacts of the divine presence, the Universal Father actually participates in the experience with immaturity and imperfection in the evolving career of every moral being of the entire universe. Human limitations, potential evil, are not a part of the divine nature, but mortal experience with evil and all man's relations thereto are most certainly a part of God's ever-expanding self-realization in the children of time. Creatures of moral responsibility who have been created or evolved by every Creator Son going out from paradise.
Okay, now those last two, they invoke this before in what we've been reading here. Notice the key word that should have caught your attention again, ever expanding. So self-expansive deity, you know, which facet of the Father is self-expansive deity? That's the universal controller. Okay, so they're, you know, alluding to that there in passing, the universal controller hand of the Father. And then you go, oh yeah. And if I go back up in that second to the last paragraph, notice how they word this. The personal and liberating touch of the God of perfection overshadows the hearts and encircles the natures of all those mortal creatures who have ascended to the universe level of moral discernment. Okay, so put that all together. There's three things in there that they're putting together. Okay, so they have this benchmark point that they're reminding you of, you know, that you don't start out being encircled in the Holy Spirit, you know, when you're conceived or even when you're born. You have to get to almost 6 years old on average before you're encircled in the Holy Spirit. You know, have the second cosmic intuition, moral discrimination, you know, and have ascended to the universe level of moral discernment. Okay, so up to that point, you are being upheld. You are in the hand of God the Mother. She is holding you, upholding you up to that point. Because you can't yet choose anything. You don't have personality manifesting yet. You're not a mind of will dignity yet in and of yourself. You need to be upheld by the Mother. So you've got that. They're invoking that image. You have that initial phase of being upheld. So there's this hand below you, the hand of the Mother. And then you get to this critical point of development. And what happens? There's another hand that comes in that overshadows the hearts. So in comes a hand from above, overshadows, not upholding, but an overshadows hand that engages you, you know, the actuality of you, your heart, you know, that temple within, that core of your being that you now have because you've been encircled in the Holy Spirit. That hand that's gripping you as an actuality, that's the universal controller. And when we talked about this, the Father engages you in a twofold fashion. Because how is the Father engaging you? He's engaging you through the sevenfold. You know, you have these two hands of the Father, the universal controller and the universal Father, you know, that are coming down to engage you. That's the two things they're invoking here. So in comes the one hand that gets a grip on you and overshadows the heart. Okay, that's the universal controller. Now you are held, fully held, from above and below. God is all around you. And within that, firm grip of the Father and the Mother, you are what? What does it say? And encircles that nature. That's the universal Father. So you have the Mother, and then this twofold grip from the sevenfold, the universal controller, and then the universal Father encircles you in the personality circuit. That's the image they're invoking there. Okay? But you notice how they're trying to bring this in, bring the challenge in. We can just sort of directly interpret that. But if you haven't discovered the Mother yet, think about how you would experience this statement. You know, if you stopped to really think carefully about what they just said, it's like, wait a minute, they're saying that the touch, you know, this personal liberating touch of God the Father didn't begin until you ascended to the universe level of moral discernment, until you had a mind of will dignity. That should give you pause. You know, if you're still in that mode where you're trying to make everything work with just God the Father, you know, hand, and probably still a very anthropomorphic, you know, one at that, like they've just been trying to point out to us. Notice how they're building this. It's like, okay, You know, they're getting you to face the limitations of the historical notions of God the Father. They're building that up. They're inspiring you with the really definitive passages in the Bible that speak to the truth of the eternal perfection of the Father. And then they're giving you this factual nugget that, you know, they're challenging you with. Are you ready now to face this fact that in order to have a whole picture that's logical, in order to not think, well, so God apparently just, he just tosses us out there and we're floundering around until finally he deems that, you know, we're worthy of him engaging us. That doesn't sound like God either. I mean, it's like, you know, but they're saying that the Father is, so I know that God has to still be there with me. If it's not the Father, who is it? It's obviously the Mother, okay? So that's, they're giving you that whole picture. And there's three things in play. There's three columns. Yeah, the Mother, the Controller, and the Father.
How specifically you described, you know, the 4, 8, 6, the upholding of the Mother, mm-hmm. until we get to age 6.
Of course, onward.
You know. Yeah, right, right.
She's always upholding. But,
and I understand where the Father came in. He engages personality. I think.
Right. So, I mean, it has to have risen up to being a personality fact, because that's what the Father can engage.
What is a controller? How does a controller specifically come in?
The controller comes in a similar way that the Mother does. I mean, there's an actuality that both the Father and the Mother have to engage. That actuality is, this is very obvious how this works. When you're talking about you or me, a material will creature, we are by no means some sort of a spirit fact that some sort of spirit hand is going to grab a hold of. We need something that knows about power, that knows about matter. The Mother is right there with that. You know, innately part of, or if you want to even think about how intimate the local Mother, the creative Mother Spirit, remember before she was a creative Mother Spirit and she was just a creative Spirit, all she was really doing is conducting the power beings, very intimately associated with the power phenomenon. Okay, that's her foundational nature, upon which you've then added Mother. And that hand of the Father that engages, this material phenomenon is the universal controller. I mean, that's how he initially is sort of synchronizing with you. Finding you. He's finding you and then he's engaging you. But he has to be able to locate you. That's the hand that can locate you in the cosmos. Obviously, once there's especially once there's a thought adjuster there, he can locate that thought adjuster. But we're talking about him locating you before you have a thought adjuster. So what's the thing that he's going to grip? I mean, okay? Yeah, it has to be his hand that can grip what's there before the adjuster's there. Okay, that's the universal controller hand. Now, that's fundamentally why, there are two columns here in the sevenfold. It's a twofold process for the Father to downreach and engage. Just the universal Father can't do it. It takes both to do it. And we even, we even brought that up, as one way that you can kind of think about it from our time viewpoint. When you start thinking about the God the sevenfold from a time viewpoint, in here in the sevenfold creators, you've got the Supreme Being. Well, from a time viewpoint, the Supreme Being doesn't exist yet. So how can I even understand how the sevenfold can get to me? From a time viewpoint, it's like, okay, I know the universal Father exists, the eternal Son exists, and the conjoined actor exists, but gap. I don't, from a time viewpoint, the Supreme Being doesn't exist, and so that hand can't even get down to me. It's like the, there's a circuit is cut. There's a gap from a time viewpoint. Well, not here. This comes right down and engages us. And so it's a way of understanding how even how you can take the time viewpoint very literally and still understand what's going on. That's how he can get to us when there is not yet a supreme being to complete that column there of the sevenfold creators. It's still totally logical that he can engage us. Now, obviously, from an eternity viewpoint, there is a supreme being, and that's a different story. But it's just important to recognize that you can think in both ways. Remember, and that's a challenge to both understand it from the time viewpoint and the eternity viewpoint together, so that you appreciate the fullness of your relationship to God. That it isn't just coming down, it's also coming up. There's and you are in the middle, that are held above and below. And then in that full grip, you can be encircuited. If you tried to encircuit without containing you, you'd just get jerked out of that circuit. You'd be caught up in the flow of the circuit. And I mean, you have to be. They're helping you to be localized as a universe phenomenon by their hands.
I remember reading in the Supreme Papers and reflecting on the two parts of the Supreme, and that bottom part, and I'm thinking Almighty. The controller is what does this. It brings it to a level of, and I remember the phrase, equilibrium concepts. Mm-hmm. And then that top part can start to have an effect once it's in a relative patient mode, an equilibrium concept. It's regular. It's dependable. Yeah. Like Jesus said about John, he was dependable.
Right. See, and that's a theme that you'll see repeated over and over as you start to think about. You'll see that over and over how there's this twofold thing when you try to actually understand it logically, you need both in order to actually understand. Just like when you're thinking about being engaged by the thought adjuster. If there isn't the temple within, if that place isn't prepared, where in the heck is it going to go? It has to have a place prepared for it. Okay? The mother is fostering this, bringing you up from the bottom, so that supplying the favorable conditions for the adjuster to come down from above. There's always a bidirectional phenomenon. And the mother and the father meet in the middle and hold the child.
I think I've mentioned it some place in the years that I've been here, but remember that picture I think it was in the 70s, it was a poster of it. It was so beautiful. It reminds me of the mother. There's two or three little, there are two little kids, a boy and a girl, and they're about 3 years old. Pardon? No, they're on a bridge, and there's the holes in the bridge.
Oh, yeah.
And then there's the beautiful mother spirit or angel, and she's protecting them. Mm-hmm. That's exactly what comes to my mind when you talk about the mother protecting the child until he gets to the thought adjuster stage.
And beyond. I mean, you never can float in free space. You always have to have something to stand on. She's always there. You're always standing on her. I just want everyone to appreciate, you can see how basically everything we read, it's there. I mean, it's not like you only can find the mother when you go up there in the Supreme Papers in that one section in the middle of that closing Pentateuch of papers. She's everywhere. They're just trying to get you to discover her experientially. They put these little challenges out there. It's like, okay, now I just said this. Now you have a choice. Either you conclude that me, the author, that I'm incapable of constructing a logical sentence You know, you're just going, well, this doesn't make any sense. I mean, this is illogical. Well, I don't know who in the heck wrote this, but it certainly wasn't a so-called divine counselor.
Sounds like
you know, Fuller. You know, it's, I mean, okay. You know, or are you going to wait a minute? They've drawn a boundary here, and they're saying, okay, so this is the Father, but God has to be everywhere. What's here? If the Father's here, what's here? You know, it's just that challenge is always there. You know, we'll, as we go through almost everything in the book, as we read paper after paper after paper, you'll see it's just over and over and over again. It's right there for you to recognize. You know, if you challenge what you're reading logically. You know, so you know, and you know, how can you challenge something logically? Because you've been given logical acumen, the first cosmic intuition. Who gave you that? She did. Yeah. See, the appropriateness of it, that's the way the book is constructed. Through her, you can find her. If you don't use your cosmic intuitions, you're not going to find her in here. You have to go through her to find her. Because this reveals the truth of her. That's the only way to find her in here, is through her. Take the light in cultivating, and then you find her. That's the way they construct it. All right, who wants to do... All right. Okay, so we got the kind of the basics there, infinity and eternity, if you will, or, you know, or the infinite and the eternal. Now we're going to get into justice and mercy and that line about the nature of the Father.
Part 3, justice and righteousness. God is righteous, therefore is he just. The Lord is righteous in all his ways. I have not done without cause all that I have done, says the Lord. The judgments of the Lord are true and righteous altogether. The justice of the universal Father cannot be influenced by the acts and performances of his creatures. For there is no iniquity with the Lord our God, no respect of persons. No taking of gifts.
You're not going to coerce or But notice how it starts out. God is righteous, therefore is he just. Therefore, okay, a deductive word. Are you thinking deductively? Do you understand that sentence deductively? Like they're trying to get you to think by using the word therefore. Okay, so what is righteousness? Righteousness is conformity with the cosmos. If you go up there into paper 16 and they're talking about, the cosmic intuitions, right? Righteousness is conformity with the cosmos. Okay, so if you're conformal with the cosmos, then you have all the levels of meaning have been brought into play, you know, and you're now functioning in some sort of cosmic system. You know, so if you have that, the totality of that in play, of course you've got just. You have just and fair and patient and kind and merciful and loving. You have all of them. You know, if you're conformal with the cosmos, if you're righteous, you have all of them. So therefore, you have one of them, just, the foundation, first just. Okay, they're invoking the levels of meaning, and recognition of that. Okay, so God is righteous, therefore is he just. You know, therefore is he law-abiding and honest.
First level of meaning.
Right. Law-abiding and honest. You know, and he makes the laws, and he abides by them. He doesn't break his own laws. He's law-abiding. He's not a radical who's, you know, out on a rebellious tear against the laws, okay?
Oh, yeah, I rewrite these every couple of years.
I put them out there, but then behind your back, I'm not obeying them, you know, I'm not honest, yeah. And, you know, no, yeah. God is just, okay? And if you want to be godlike, you have to first be just, then fair, then patient, okay?
How futile to make puerile appeals to such a God to modify his changeless decrees so that we can avoid the just consequences of the operation of his wise natural laws and righteous spiritual mandates. Be not deceived, God is not mocked, for whatsoever a man sows, that shall he also reap. True, even in the justice of reaping the harvest of wrongdoing, this divine justice is always tempered with mercy. Infinite wisdom is the eternal arbiter which determines the proportions of justice and mercy which shall be meted out in any given circumstances. The great punishment in reality and
the greatest punishment.
The greatest punishment in reality and inevitable consequence for wrongdoing and deliberate rebellion against the government of God is loss of existence as an individual subject of that government.
That's rebellion against the government.
The law, so they use the word government, see?
The final result of wholehearted sin is annihilation. In the last analysis, such sin-identified individuals have destroyed themselves by becoming wholly unreal through their embrace of iniquity. The factual disappearance of such a creature is, however, always delayed until the ordained order of justice current in that universe has been fully complied with.
Just one little, let's bring it a little bit before. The next paragraph builds on this too, but let me just bring out a couple things. Does everyone appreciate that? That little passage from Galatians there. Be not deceived. God is not mocked. You know what mocked means. You can't go around this. You're not going to somehow circumvent. God's laws. Okay, think about where they're coming from. Are you actually going to somehow go around infinity and eternity? No, there's no boundary. There's no going around it. Okay, it's inescapable. And so everywhere you go is the love of God and the law of God. Same time, equal proportion. I just wanted to, make sure that, you appreciated that.
God is not mocked, for whatsoever a man sows, that shall he also reap. I don't understand
that. Don't think that somehow you can circumvent God's laws. He's not going to be mocked. Ha, fooled you. You wanted to impose that law on me, but I found a way around it. God is not mocked. If you do that which it doesn't conform with the laws of the cosmos, you pay the consequences. If you jump off of a cliff, you fall. Okay? He's not going to stop the law of gravity for you. You have to recognize the law of gravity and work with the law of gravity. Not say, if there's a God, he'll reach in and float me. No, he won't. He's not going to circumvent his laws.
That's what they were doing with Jesus.
Right. Yeah. The laws are there for a reason. They're not an affront to the love of God. They're in perfect harmony with the love of God. And the notions, the historical notions of God don't allow that thought. That's cosmic consciousness, that you can have the law and the love woven together. Spiritual consciousness wants to deny the law and just focus on the love. But there is no love without law. And there's no law without love. They're coming from the first source and center. And there's no separation between creator and controller, between power and personality. That's before the separation. They can't be separated by even a nanometer. They're coming from one unified source. Law is love, and love is law. Despite the fact that we experience them as diametric opposites to start with. That's just our subjective ignorance about the facts. You know, it's just like, you know, you have all the father fragments and you turn them around and you have the force charge of space. You have the love and the law. They're the same thing. Two sides of one thing. You know, so they're trying to stress that. So, you know, the moment that you bring up justice, you have to also talk about mercy because it's a simultaneous phenomenon. Justice and mercy are in parallel, you know, and together.
I don't understand law.
The universe has form. It's constructed in a certain way, and that's just the way it is. Oxygen has definitive properties. Period. God is not going to deoxygenize oxygen. The facts of oxygen are the law of God. The facts of everything, like the part of the law of God is that the way it's constructed, the adjutants cannot engage simultaneously. They have to engage one at a time. That's part of the law of God. It's like, well, I don't like a God that gives me adjutants one at a time. I like a God that gives me all seven adjutants at once. I'm going to believe in that kind of God. Well, there is no such God. Okay? You can't make up the laws of God. God defines the laws. You just have to recognize that that's the way it works, and nothing's going to change that. You get one, and then you get two, and then you get three, and you don't get seven until you're pushing 6 years old, on average. It's like, well, I don't like that. I want seven to come while I'm still in the womb. That's not the way it works. That's not the law of God. Okay, the law of God is it comes then. Your challenge is to figure out why it comes in. Because there's a perfect reason why it comes in, not before and not after. What is it? If you can understand why it comes in, now you're beginning to actually strike step with the fact of God. And not just striking step with your belief system, the God you fabricated in your mind and want to believe. I want this God. You know, well, you don't get a choice. You know, you don't get to make God. God is. You have to engage the God that is. You know, and it's like, and they're trying to give you the way that you can get past that initial stumbling block about that is, notice that you believe in a perfect, infinite, eternal God. Therefore, everything that comes from Him is perfect. His laws are perfect. Why would you want anything besides His laws, the perfect laws? Put that thought first. Not your subjective experience where they don't seem to be perfect. You have to know they're perfect and then challenge your perception that they're imperfect. And how long will it take you to challenge that perception until you see them as absolutely perfect? It'll take all eternity for you to complete that task. But you'll be able to see their finite perfection when you're a finaliter. You know, no more will you say, you know, I don't think these laws are quite perfect. You will perfectly see their finite perfectness when you're a finaliter. No longer will there be this dissonance between your consciousness and the fact of God. Your consciousness will be in harmony with the fact of God.
I love following scientific discoveries in the media and hearing how scientists just over and over again, the more they know, the more it stupefies them. One thing recently coming up about the distribution of matter in space as it can be observed from our position in space, mm-hmm. and it doesn't make any sense because it's too uniform and it's not clumped just right, and they can't explain it, and it doesn't seem to follow the laws of gravity, but it's obviously following some law and they don't get it. It's just fun to watch.
You know, scientists need more humility than they have right now, for sure. Again, because there's this tendency for them to think just like religionists have often thought. God is what I think God is. You know, the laws of physics are what I think the laws of physics are. No, the laws of physics care less what you think. could care less if you exist or not. Okay? They just are. You are humbly trying to discover them. All right. Okay, so let's see. I'm just trying to remind myself what else was in there. Let's see. Annihilation. Yeah, okay, let's read the next section, and then we'll talk a little bit more about that whole issue. Yeah. Or next paragraph, I mean.
Cessation of existence is usually decreed at the dispensational or epical adjudication of the realm or realms. On a world such as Urantia, it comes at the end of a planetary dispensation. Cessation of existence can be decreed at such times by coordinate action of all tribunals of jurisdiction, extending from the planetary council up through the courts of the Creator Sun to the judgment tribunals of the Ancient of Days.
Ancients.
Ancients of Days. The mandate of dissolution originates in the higher courts of the super universe, following an unbroken confirmation of the indictment originating in the sphere of the wrongdoer's residence. And then, when sentence of extinction has been confirmed on high, the execution is by the direct act of those judges residential on and operating from the universe's, the headquarters of the super universe.
Okay, so so, you know, put all everything you've got here together. You know, one of the things that they're reminding you of, you know, or kind of introducing, if you're just reading the book for the first time, you know, is that there is this whole very definitive set of laws, you know, an established form for this whole process of adjudication. You know, so when we're talking about the laws of God, it's not some simple little thing. It's infinitely complex. You know, here's a little example. Just, you know, to say an introductory statement about this process, they gave you all this, you know, allusion to complexity here. Now, you know, and of course, behind this, you know, between the lines here of this, we all know they're alluding to the executioners of the Ancients of Days. You know, when it finally, you know, when the sentence of extinction has been confirmed on high, the execution by the executioners is by the direct act of those judges resident on and operating from the headquarters of the super universe, the Ancients of Days. Okay, so now, but now think about this, maybe one aspect of this that you haven't really put together yet. I mean, it's very obvious what the executioner of the Ancients of Days is doing when you have a being like Lucifer, where all reality is gone. Like they were saying up there, this whole bit of this wholehearted identification with iniquity, with nothingness. You know, remember, personality has to have an identification point. It has to have an identification point. And your choice is, are you going to identify it with an eternal fact, the adjuster? Or are you going to identify it with an eternal nothing? Yeah, I mean, you know, you have to identify. Personality has to have an identification point, and it's your choice whether it identifies with something or nothing. And so, I mean, Lucifer, you know, is iniquitous now. He's identified with nothingness. You know, his personality is now identified with nothingness. So it has no relationship to the rest of reality. He's unreal. And at some point, this is all going to be confirmed, and the executioner is going to show up. And that actuality, his body, that's no longer a reality, is just going to be, you know, dispersed, okay, back into the energy potentials of the cosmos, okay? Now, but for you and I, it's like, well, how does this work? I mean, you know, they don't seem to be limiting this. They're saying that all this is coming down from the Ancients of Days, that the Ancients of Days are directly involved in what happens with you if you choose iniquity. Well, I mean, You know, it's not like I'm going to have this eternal body that's, you know, there's going to need to be an executioner to disperse. I mean, I die, my material body is gone. Okay, now I have this soul, but of course, if I've made it to iniquity in this life, that soul is empty. It has no value in it. It's an empty husk. And remember how that works. There is a resurrection of the unjust, quote unquote. The angels, you know, your guardian angels take possession of that soul when you die. Whether or not they're pretty certain that it's hollow, you know, empty or not, they take possession of the vessel, and they show up, at the resurrection time, the appointed resurrection time, with that soul. Okay, but remember how that story goes. What doesn't happen? Someone doesn't show up. The adjuster doesn't show up. Okay, so, and remember how this works. For the adjuster to show up, the adjuster can't go directly from Divinington to you, to the mansion, first mansion, we'll say. The adjuster has to go through the Ancients of Days. The Ancients of Days have to register an adjuster in to the super universe and into the local universe. Okay, the Ancients of Days are in charge of this. If the Ancients of Days will not register that adjuster in, that adjuster does not show up. You've been judged. Yeah. See? Yeah. That's how you're judged. The Ancients of Days do not register an adjuster in. Yeah.
Are you aware that you're waiting for the adjuster?
No, of course not. No. I mean, even if you're, you know, almost totally divine, you know, this soul is magnificent. You're unconscious. There's no knowledge of anything. And so that, you know, that's how the Ancients of Days are involved when it's, you know, you and I, you and me. I did it again. See, I do it every time. Jeez, terrible with that.
Isn't you and I the correct way to say it?
No. They do it with me. Not with I. See, no, I do it, but they do it with me.
Beyond my level of protection.
Well,
that's why the example helps you.
Right.
Trivial.
Yep.
It specifically says God does not judge his creation. So if the adjuster doesn't show up, that's in a sense a judgment.
No. There's no judgment in play. What do they say? The greatest punishment in reality, an inevitable consequence. Okay, this is just a factual thing. Why didn't the ancients of days register an adjuster in? Because they used the universal sensors, their microscopes, to examine that soul, and they found not one speck of reality in it. It's clean as a whistle on the inside. Okay.
That you were iniquitous because the adjuster didn't show up.
No, I'm just put it all together. I mean, what they're doing, it's always factual. There's no, where did they just say that? Somewhere here, we just read that bit about, here. God's primal perfection consists not in an assumed righteousness. No one, be it the Father or an Ancient of Days, is assuming anything and just decreeing something. Well, I don't like that person. I'm not going to let the adjuster in. You know, you've been judged. You know, there's no assumption going on here at all. They have, you know, a final discernment ability. They can figure out if there's anything there at all, even a shadow of something, you know.
The Ancients of Days.
They're the last examiners of this.
No amount of eternity could save that.
Right. There is nothing there. There's nothing to save. Okay. You can save something, but you can't save nothing.
So you're saying the Ancients of Days decide whether or not the adjuster comes back.
Right. And a decision is based upon whether or not they've found the soul to be empty or having something in it.
Okay.
If the soul is empty, then... No, the Ancients of Days. Again, an adjuster can only come to a temple. there's no place prepared for that adjuster. The ancients of days looked, they said, there's nothing prepared for you, I'm sorry. Okay, that person chose to not be, you know. They chose to not create a space for you. They took the space that was given to them as a gift by the grace of God, and they shrunk it until it was zero volume, and now there's no space for you anymore.
So let's say the soul, the person dies, and they become a sleeping survivor, and then the planetary dispensation. Then when they bring all the souls,
mm-hmm.
then that person, or he probably doesn't have a person anymore, but that soul,
mm-hmm.
empty, he's awake right then.
No. You, there's no way to make him awake without an adjuster. The adjuster reincircuiting in the soul is what awakens the soul.
The pieces aren't all there.
The adjuster reanimates you. Okay, there's a question over here.
When it comes to survival from death on this planet,
mm-hmm.
It's my understanding is it's not only a matter of completely identifying with iniquity, but that there can also be people that just don't grow a soul, that don't spiritualize at all.
Well, I mean,
by focusing on material reality all the time or whatever.
Yeah, but how hard is that now with the post-Pentecost?
I'm just curious.
There's no iniquitous six-year-olds.
So
the only way that you don't have a soul, and if you haven't chosen iniquity and evaporated your soul, that means you were never human in the first place. You were subhuman. You never got at least the seventh adjutant, if not more. And, you know, if you didn't get the seventh adjutant, you weren't encircled in the Holy Spirit. You aren't a mind of will dignity. I mean, you know, no. So,
do the math. So basically from, it would be reasonable from this perspective to assume that 90%+ of people survive. Our resurrection.
I mean, like you said, I mean, we don't have to assume anything. I mean, really. I mean, the angels, do the angels try to make an assumption? Do they try to count? It's like, well, I think it's 95. No, I think it's 96%. No. What do they tell you up there about the angels, you know, tell this same story up there in the, you know, in the paper there about this, you know, and the angels say, okay, those are the facts, but that's all irrelevant to us. We ignore all those facts. Those facts don't have any relationship with us. We act as if it's a child of God, even if, from our perspective, it looks like it's nothing.
Because they don't have the final say.
Iniquitous, yeah, you know, they do that. And even if they can tell it's a subhuman to start with, there's still a group of angels that minister to those subhumans. Okay? So in terms of your relationship as a person to others, you always attempting to relate personally. But now you have to also have the other eye open, just like Jesus told you. You know, if you can, you know, if you're confronted with something that there's no way to engage personally, now the best thing would be to not be taking this on as an individual, to bring a non-personal expression of you, you know, the government, in to deal with that apparently subhuman phenomenon. But if, you know, if the logistics don't work, if you can't, you know, get your cell phone out, you know, I mean, you're going to have to deal with that, and you may have to decide, you know, I think I should just use whatever force is necessary here because I don't think I'm dealing with anything that's, you know, functioning in any sort of a Son of God way, you know, and, you know, Jesus, you know, said if he was confronted with that, he could tell it was a subhuman phenomenon, he would use whatever force was necessary to deal with it. He's not going to let a subhuman phenomenon kill him. You know?
Dealt with someone once, and they just wouldn't listen to reason. And I just, you know, and they just started, it was like an animal setting off their territory. And it was like I realized, you know, best thing to do is to, you know, tactfully get out of
there. Right. I mean.
Because...
Develop the wisdom so that you don't have to go into attack mode. I mean, you should be wise enough to not get into that.
Right.
Have a little bit of foresight and forethought here to not, you know, walk into the lion's den, for Christ's sake.
It looks like temperament.
So, temperament. So,
yep.
Okay, so the thought have Jester after you die. I mean, he's still with you until you die. And then he goes up to Divinity.
Right.
And then he's telling his story about, well, this is what this person, you know, is. And then that's when they make the judgment. Is that how it works?
No. I mean, like they said, it starts with the angels who have kept a record, you know, and it goes up through the whole assessment. There's a reflective engagement that the adjuster puts into that. Everything, you know, the ancients of, you know, it goes all the way up the chain of command until finally the ancients of days have the whole picture in front of them, and they make the final assessment. Not judgment, really. See, it's just an assessment. Is there something or not? That's all they're doing. And they have all of this information, all this input. So-and-so says there's nothing. So-and-so says there's nothing. It keeps coming up the chain. You know, maybe it gets all the way up the chain, everyone's saying that there's nothing there, but they're the last link, and they go, actually, there is. It's so small that you can't see it, but there is something there. Resurrect that.
In comes the adjuster.
You know, and remember what, the way this is working. I mean, the ancients of days may full well know that what's there is so distorted that it's basically 100% that being is going to choose iniquity on the mansion worlds. But they'll resurrect anyway. Remember, they would rather have a rebellion in the system than to not resurrect something that actually is something, no matter how tiny and distorted it is and how certain it's going to blow up once you resurrect it. They'll resurrect it anyway, you know?
It's the nothing is lost.
It's the only thing that isn't erected is a nothing.
And that's because
that's pretty obvious why it's not resurrected. It's nothing.
It's because they discern the Father's true will in the universe, you know? Even if it means a system rebellion, this is the will of the Father.
I mean, they're not worried about that. I mean, they know that all works out. All they're doing is trying to assess, is there something or not? You know, and humans just have never thought about it so literally. It's like, well, no, they must be kind of trying to assess the quality. And it's like, no, this is too poor a quality. No, there's no quality assessment. It's a quantity assessment. It either is a thing or it's nothing. You know, it doesn't matter how small or big it is. If it's a thing, it's a resurrected.
Even a messed up thing is a thing.
It doesn't matter how messed up it is or, yeah. It's just a question of whether or not there's substance in the soul, or if it's just an empty vessel.
In the case of soul death, doesn't the adjuster leave?
Right. Right. I mean, if you choose iniquity, and during your mortal life, the adjuster leaves. You know, maybe you continue to live for 50 years, but the adjuster left because, you know, it has to. Why did it leave? Not because, you know, it tasted bad anymore. There's no place to be.
No place.
If you're iniquitous, you've shrunk the temple down to zero volume. Yeah. You squeezed him out. There's no place for him to be anymore. It's all literally factual. Nothing is happening in some arbitrary way. It's literal. You know, if the adjuster left, it's because there's no place for him, not because he didn't want to be there anymore. He has to stay as long as there's volume.
Yeah.
He only leaves when the volume goes to zero.
Regardless of conditions.
Yeah. You know, you may be the most insanely sinful phenomenon the world has ever seen, but you're not iniquitous yet. There's still a tiny little volume there, and the adjuster is crammed into it, okay? Okay? And it has to live in the midst of that nightmare, okay? It's imprisoned in your mind. It will stay until there's no place to be. You have to go all the way to iniquity. Again, you can't go into examples. There just isn't. It's impossible to do that. And the point is not to try. See, we always want to try to, well, I want to make sure that I'm on the right side of the line. Well, you know you're on the right side of the line. There's no issue here. And you.
I was trying to think, what would be that one little thing that would keep that person?
There could be some tiny little. Maybe there may be, like I've pointed out, maybe there's one person on the entire earth that individual has a tenuous little relationship with that has some value, a tiny little thread of value. It's a nightmare everywhere else. If there's one little thread, the only way there can be a thread of connection to other is if there's something there. Okay, that means there's some tiny little speck of reality left. If there's nothing left, that person can't put a thread to link to some, to someone else. So that's, you can assess this in two ways. You can assess it directly, is there anything there? Or you can look at it phenomenologically. If there's something there, it's connected to something else. See, so there's two ways they can tell if there's nothing there, either just directly or by associatively. Okay.
This topic is one in which I think people who adhere to traditional Christianity are going to sort of seize up, because in that belief system, you have to believe. I mean, your belief is your ticket in.
Yeah. So you coerce God into saving you by the power of your belief. He has no choice but to save me. I believe so fervently. I mean, this is a ridiculous notion when you actually just say it out loud. I mean, obviously, it doesn't work that way.
I think that's more indicative.
It has to be objective, not subjective.
Well, and the thing that this is where my poor mother is so confused, because she was always taught that. But you can't just will yourself to believe something that's invisible, and she has never grasped that. And I have tried to explain to my mother that the wonderful beauty of this is that it is so, whether or not you believe it. Mm-hmm. Right. And that is very comforting to her, because forcing herself to believe something that isn't experiential for her yet has been very hard.
Yeah, and in terms of surviving this life, this life as a mortal creature post Pentecost, belief is just not in play. You have to know God. In order to become iniquitous, you have to know God and reject that knowingness. Okay, you can't become iniquitous unless you first actually really know God. If you're just totally clueless and don't really know God, iniquity's not even an option yet. Okay? you've got to get into a full-blown, clear vision knowing of God and then reject that. It's not about rejecting some doctrine or some belief or not believing, or that has nothing to do with it. And that is, like you said, where's the historical precedent for such an objective thought about this? There isn't any. There's all historical precedent is some gobbledygook, subjective rationalization scheme.
That always used to really bother me too, because I had no experience of being able to create things by simply believing them. Mm-hmm. And that's pretty much, I think, where they're at. I want a more solid universe. I want it to be there whether or not I believe it, and I want it to be there. Even if I'm not here, I want it to be there.
Right. Because if it isn't like that, you don't want to be part of it.
Yeah.
Why would you want to be part of an illusion?
Yeah.
You want to be part of reality.
It's like that little argument about if a tree falls in the forest and no one's there to hear it, is there sound?
Yes.
Well, of course there is. And I want there to be sound, and I don't want it to have to be so subjective. If there's no ear to hear it, there's no sound.
Yeah. All right. Let's get a little bit more here.
When this sentence is finally confirmed, the sin-identified being instantly becomes as though he had not been. There is no resurrection from such a fate. It is everlasting and eternal. The living energy factors of identity are resolved by the transformations of time and the metamorphosis of space into the cosmic potentials whence they once emerged. As for the personality of the iniquitous one, it is deprived of a continuing life vehicle by the creature's failure to make those choices and final decisions which would have assured eternal life. When the continued embrace of sin by the associated mind culminates in complete self-identification with iniquity. Then upon the cessation of life, upon cosmic disillusion, such an isolated personality is absorbed into the oversoul of creation, becoming a part of the evolving experience of the Supreme Being. Never again does it appear as a personality. Its identity becomes as though it had never been. In the case of an adjuster indwelt personality, the experiential spirit values survive in the reality of the continuing adjuster.
You know, not to mention, of course, the, you know, the reflective wake in the cosmos, too. You know, we've talked about that a lot when we went through all this back, you know, when we were talking about God the Supreme. And let's just, you know, quickly remind ourselves, you know, this whole bit about using that term oversoul and attaching that to the fact of the Supreme Being. But it's not so much that they're, you know, that's in play here. You know, it's the evolving experience of the Supreme Being. So, you know, we're talking about God the Supreme down in time and space. And you know, this whole bit about it, that measure of purposing, you know, when they talk about your personality is absorbed into, okay, that measure of purposing that was did have this distinct point of identification with fact, that now no longer has that point of identification, that purposing doesn't go away, because again, it's part of the Father. The Father's changeless. He's not going to say, well, now that I think about it, that purposing's irrelevant anyway. I don't need that measure of purposing. No, I mean, that measure of purposing has to be. You've just chosen to not let it be through you. But that purposing still has to be. And, you know, it becomes part of, you know, when you're thinking about it down in you know, God the Supreme down in space and time, it's God the Almighty. It becomes part of the purposing that is God the Almighty, you know, not so much God the Mother, because again, you know, God the Mother, you know, when you think about God the Supreme, and then you come down into time and space, and you have one aspect that's a downflowing phenomenon, and one aspect that's an upflowing phenomenon, you know, the two together are God the Supreme. Above that, down here, there are these two phases. You know, you're an upwelling phenomenon, this purposing that was associated with you. If you choose iniquity, that purposing goes into the collective upwelling phenomenon instead of this individual upwelling phenomenon that was you. It becomes part of the purposing of God the Almighty. Yeah.
That is the drop of water in the ocean.
Right, that is the drop of water in the ocean. Yeah. You know, the purposing becomes a drop of water in that ocean, in the Supreme Ocean. You know, and again, you know, like if you think this whole bit about resolved by the transformations of time and the metamorphoses of space, you know, again, in the case of you, if the ancients today say, no, it's empty, that soul is empty, remember, that's Maurontia's substance, that vessel. It's an artificial substance. It's being held together by the Maurontia power supervisors and the master physical controllers. I mean, all they have to do is just let go of it, and it just, you know, diffuses, okay? So that one's easy. It's not like you have to bring an executioner in. They just let go of it, okay?
Walk away from the empty thing.
Yeah, it's about to come apart. So that's, you know, that's what they're invoking in. And see, notice again, that self-identification. It's a binary thing. There must be self-identification. The question is it identification with the adjuster? You know, in the case of us, or, you know, how you become eternal is to identify with the adjuster, or nothing. You know, self-identification with iniquity, with nothingness, or with the adjuster, eternity or oblivion. But that's the thing that helps you to resolve all this, to separate the identification from the purposing. They're two separate things. There's this purposing, and that's not going anywhere. That's changeless. Yeah. Okay. The question is, what does it identify? You know, how does it achieve identification? Through you or through the Supreme? It will achieve identification. It must. The purposing must achieve identification. It's either going to be through you or through the Supreme. It's your choice.
The job's not lost. Right.
That's why I keep stressing it, because I know this is a long-standing difficulty, and it's this, it's blurring the identification into the personality that is what causes the confusion. You got to keep that as a separate fact in the phenomenon. All right.
In any universe contest between actual levels of reality, personality of the highest level, higher level, will ultimately triumph over the personality of the lower level. This inevitable outcome of universe controversy is inherent in the fact that divinity of quality equals the degree of reality or actuality of any will creature. Undiluted evil, complete error, willful sin, and unmitigated iniquity are inherently and automatically suicidal. Such attitudes of cosmic unreality can survive in the universe only because of transient mercy tolerance, pending the action of the justice determining and fairness finding mechanisms of the universe tribunals of righteous adjudication.
So notice, okay, again, see they're invoking the levels of meaning there. Notice the first two levels, level of justice and level of fairness. And they use the word mechanism. Remember, you know, the justice determining phenomenon is impersonal. You know, it's all is rooted back in the impersonal fact of the Trinity, the non-personal fact of the Trinity. Okay, and so they're engaging the subpersonal domains. You know, the third level of meaning is the level of mind. You know, when you have the seventh adjunct in play, that's when you get personality and all this stuff happening. You know, if that's not there, you know, you just have these more mechanistic-like, you know, first and second levels of meaning, the level of flesh and the level of feelings. Those are being assessed. You know, the first level is assessed by the justice determining mechanism, and the second level is assessed by the fairness finding aspect of the mechanism. They're just assessing that. Okay, so just want to make sure you caught that, and then this whole bit about, you know, undiluted evil implies complete error, you know, and if the willful sin, you know, is unmitigated iniquity, then that's suicidal. You know, they're just giving you that whole picture, and then the other thing there that might have got, you know, kind of struck you as a little bit odd is that first part. In any universe contest between actual levels of reality, the personality of the higher level will ultimately triumph over the personality of the lower level. And it's like, well, that sounds like a kind of a strange way to say that. But again, think about it very directly. It's tied back to Trinity manifestations vary the exhibition of the divine perfection, but do not attenuate it. Okay, what's that? Vary the exhibition. Okay, this divine perfection, is it being exhibited absolutely, or is it being exhibited ultimately, or is it being exhibited supremely? Okay, there's a variation there in how it's being exhibited, you know, what actual level it's manifesting on, you know, this Trinity manifestations, you know, absolute upholders, you know, et cetera. You've got that hierarchy, okay? So, and that's all they're pointing out. I mean, in terms of when you think about the logic of this vertical system, an absolute manifestation trumps an ultimate manifestation. You know, the ultimate manifestation exists within the womb of the absolute manifestation. You know, it's fundamentally subservient to the fact of the absolute. You know, so who's going to win? You know, ultimacy or absoluteness? Well, absoluteness is going to win, but of course it's not actually a competition, you know, and the big guy won. You know, it's a harmonious system, but they're just trying to remind you that it's a definite hierarchy. I mean, you know, the ultimate exists within the context of the absolute. The supreme exists within the context of the ultimate. The supreme must conform to the ultimate. You know, it has no choice.
What? Okay. That was kind of a mystery to me, how these rebellious midwares and how they, I don't remember the exact places where they indicated it, but they were subservient to higher spiritual beings. And I wonder, well, why? You know, I mean, why should they be if they were just rebellious and...
But there's what you just...
Right. I mean, now, you know, think about how, you know, you're a very lowly finite fact, but you have absolute free will in the choice between eternity and iniquity. Okay? No one can trump that. See? Now, everything else, your free will is relative. Okay? And you can get trumped. Okay? But, you know, not in your choice of eternity or iniquity. Okay? Because you have absolute free will there. You know, so they're just trying to appreciate that you exist in this very law, constructed, you know, vertical structure. It has a definite, form to it. And you have to conform to that. You know, you have no choice.
Well, and it's a part of what, if things fail to grow, we perceive them as being abnormal, you know, the standpoint of my grown-up personality has trumped my little girl personality.
Yeah.
It's a higher thing, and hopefully as it continues to grow, whatever it will be in the future will trump this.
Right.
But when things fail to grow, they're perceived as being deformed or abnormal.
Right. You should be constantly, you know, transcending that former personality. It's like this personality just trumps everything in that former personality expression. You know? You want to be moving up through this hierarchy. All right, so let's I think there's that. Yeah, there's one more paragraph here. Yeah.
The rule of the creator suns in the local universes is one of creation and spiritualization. These suns devote themselves to the effective execution of the paradise plan of progressive mortal ascension, to the rehabilitation of rebels and wrong thinkers. But when all such loving efforts are finally and forever rejected, the final decree of dissolution is executed by forces acting under the jurisdiction of the Ancients of Days.
Okay. We don't have time to kind of balance that with mercy here tonight. So I'll have to do that next week. But you know, notice kind of this reference to what you were just talking about. So it's kind of curious, you know, if you just read that again. So these sons devote themselves to the effective execution of the paradise plan of progressive mortal ascension. It's like, okay, I'm up with that. And then it says, to the rehabilitation of rebels and wrong thinkers. It's like, wow, that seems... It's like, well, what about if I'm not a rebel or a wrong thinker? Oh, wait a minute. I'm always going to be some measure of a wrong thinker. I mean, I'm moving up through the hierarchy here. You know?
You're heading for rehab.
See, so just, you know, they very purposely constructed the sentence like that to kind of catch you off guard. I mean, you need to constantly be transcending the potentials for wrong thinking that were at that lower level, you know. And he's fostering that that mortal ascension. Okay, you know, it's really kind of just kind of an interesting way to flip it around like that, and really to really sort of stress why you'd want to go up. You want to leave greater potential for wrong thinking behind. That seems a pretty obvious that you would want to have that in the rearview mirror.
Yeah, and it's also like Paradise Sons for the rehabilitation of rebels and wrong thinking. That's exactly what Jesus did with the thief on the cross. Mm-hmm. You know, he forgave him, and he said, "You'll be here, you know, with me one day in paradise." And he was probably a wrong thinker all of his life.
Well, and everyone in this room is a wrong thinker, to some degree. And that's why we all have the Spirit of Truth poured out upon us. That's, again, Michael trying to help us to, you know, it's also the Spirit of Unification, that Spirit of Truth. He's trying to lead us upward. I would lead you up. Remember, he says that in the Fear of the Lord section. You know, that Spirit of Unification is trying to do that. It's trying to lead you up. He's trying to do just what they're saying here. He's fostering this plan of the progressive mortal ascension within you, and leaving the potential for greater wrong thinking behind, only to lead that slightly lesser potential behind as well, and then that slightly lesser potential behind as well, etc., etc. You know. It always has kind of struck me the fact that they didn't put in some sort of a positive expression, that they expressed us all in the negative like that, just to kind of really make it very unappealing to be down there.
Well, see, nothing probably is appropriate to be established as a negative.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Nothing is an absence.
Yeah. Right.
Therefore, there's symmetry. Established there.
Yeah.
They got it right.
Right. You don't want to try to somehow dwell down there. The only solution is going up. The only way to be realistic is going up. Because the only way to be good in the super universe domain is to be perfecting. You know, so you have to get that ING thing happening. And he's there fostering that. I would lead you up.
The language they use indicate the mechanistic nature of justice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. And it is just very mechanistic.
And we have in our idioms, you know, the what do we say? That the wheels of justice grind slowly.
Right.
See, it's a recognition of that mechanistic nature of justice.
The blindfold, you know.
You know, is there, again, is, you know, it's, you know, true justice is impersonal. It's a very matter-of-fact mechanistic thing. I mean, what is justice fundamentally? Justice is applied law. Mm-hmm. Okay? That's all it is. There's nothing personal in it. It's just applied law. Mercy is the personal side. That's applied love. That's the personal side. You know, true justice is impersonal. And the extent to which humans try to be expressions of true justice in their systems, they have to make it as impersonal, as group phenomenon as possible. You know, to try to sink it as much to the Trinity as possible. Not to the Father. It needs to be synchronized to the Trinity. It needs to be synchronized to that impersonal fact, non-personal fact.
So a society has to determine amongst themselves what is the baseline standard that we're going to have as justice. And for those that want it a lower level, maybe they can't stay in the nation. insist on having it a lower level than the level that the people have decided. Mm.
Right. I mean,
it makes it a tenuous set, because right now it seems like in our country, you know, this whole thing of justice is.
The point is, yes, I mean, you know, the United States is in an attempt to really manifest this fact on earth, you know, to make justice as impersonal phenomenon as possible, because historically it's been practically anything but, you know, and the extent to which you are not challenging yourself to make justice on the non-personal side, you're just not living up to the demands of what of the concept of the formation of this country. If you don't want it like that, it's like, no, that's too hard. I like revenge and retribution, and you know, I like, you know, that sort of justice. I like personal justice. Well, then, you know, this is not the place for you. You need to go somewhere else, or that's what they think justice is. You know, to live here is to challenge yourself to identify justice with the Trinity, not with some personal phenomenon.
Okay. Isn't it okay to identify it with mercy?
Justice, mercy.
I mean, you can choose to do that too. You don't have to go that revenge
but, way. But again, yeah, I mean, you're going to do both. Like Jesus modeled it. The religious life of Jesus and how he lived it. He's facing the condemned criminal. He recognized that justice was in play. Law was being applied. He didn't challenge that. But he ministered mercy in the framework of the justice. You know, it's not justice or mercy. You know, it's justice and mercy. You as a person can administer mercy. The group administers justice. You know, and if you as a person start saying, well, I don't like having a group that administers justice, we should just get rid of that whole justice notion. Can't we all just have nothing but love? There is no such universe. In the actual universe, there's law and love simultaneously. If you're going to be part of that reality, you have to find a way to express law and love and their applications, justice and mercy, at the same time. And this and the key thing in order to be able to do that simultaneously is one is impersonal and one is personal. That's why they can coexist. If they're both personal, they can't coexist. The reason the Eternal Son and the Isle of Paradise can coexist is because one is absolutely personal and the other is absolutely non-personal.
So like when you're raising a child, you might be not having enough. In my case, I don't think I had enough of that law. And I think I was more merciful.
Mm-hmm. If it gets too freewheeling, yeah. Yeah, I mean, children need form. Yeah, they need love, but they need form also.
That's why Jesus said
they need both.
John Mark, love with wisdom. You had a home that had love with wisdom.
Right. Okay. All right. So
balanced by wisdom.
So next time we'll pick up on that. You know, you get the little introduction to mercy, and then we get into the full blown gigantic section on love. So we'll pick up that little bit more heartening side of the equation next time. But notice the order. Just notice the order here. Did they give you love and then mercy and then justice? No. They gave you justice, then mercy, then love. You know, because they wanted you to face facts and adjust them to ideals in order to achieve wisdom. Very purposeful way they constructed it, you know. They're trying to challenge that desire. It's like, well, I don't want to think about the justice stuff and the law stuff. It's scary, you know. Yeah, but you'd want to. You want to be wise, so you need to face those facts, you know, and then bring love into that the midst of that form. All right, let's take a moment here.